So we left off, if I'm not mistaken, 2 weeks ago, talking about a basic principle of talking to Blios, that Blios need something, they need almost a conduit in order to transfer, in order to travel. And that conduit is going to be a rotev, going to be a liquid, some kind of a liquid medium has to be able to take something which is absorbed in one item and bring it to the other item. So the Gemara speaks about this in terms of two chatichos. If you have a chaticha that has a bli of treifus in it, and then that one chaticha is touching another chaticha, but they're both dry. So the Gemara pretty much, at least according to most Rishonim, says that ein balua yotz bechaticha latichel adei reitev, that something which is only balua, it's only a absorption into one thing, cannot travel to the other one unless there's some kind of a liquid to help it schlep along. So the Rishonim extrapolated from this the principle that I think we left off at the end of the shiur, that ein kli balev kli elai adei reitev, that if you have a kli that has some kind of either treifus in it, or you have a fleshix in it, and that kli touches another kli, so that blia, that absorption, doesn't travel. It's just two, everything's dry, so one doesn't travel to another. And we mentioned that's the reason, at least one of the primary reasons, why we have a practice, most of us have a practice, that we use burners on the stove, back and forth for fleshix and melchix. Most people are not so machbid on this, that they'll put a pot of cholent, those used to make cholent on the stoves, yeah, chicken soup, take a pot of chicken soup, put it on the stove, they'll take it off, and then now an hour later, they'll put a pot of milk there, and most people are not so careful about that. Why is that? Aren't they blias? Ramesh writes, Shuvah, no. He doesn't think they're really blias, because ein balua yotze mechatich haticho, in this case, ein balea, ein balua yotze mi kadeira le kadeira, ein balua yotze mi pot le great, from great le pot, ela ayadei reitiv. What if there is a little bit of a reitiv? What if there is a little bit of a moisture there? So the Chavos Das writes that reitiv means reitiv. It means, gravy. It's flooding with a liquid, a little moisture, a little residue. That's not considered to be sufficient reitiv for the blias to travel. And therefore, the minhag ha'olam is pretty much lahakel. Even though the minhag ha'olam is lahakel, the Ramah quotes a practice in Uchas Pesach that for Pesach we're not making on this. The Ramah quotes from the Haril, that if you have a tripod or something, they have a metal item that you put a pot on top of. So there are more quotes that you shouldn't use your chobot stick, a stand that you put your pots on all year long. You shouldn't use that on Pesach unless you kasher it first. Why not? The ikra didn't really mutter. The ikra then the blia doesn't go from the blia of chobot doesn't go from that stand to the Pesach sticker pot. So why should that be a problem? So Ramosha writes, you're right, that really Mikra didn't shvila to be muta. The Guru writes this way, yeah, Mikra didn't shvila to be muta. The two magic words, Chumrah the Chometz. Chometz trumps everything. Hilchos Pesach trumps everything. What does it mean, Chumrah the Chometz? Chumrah the Chometz doesn't mean that things that are totally muta become all of a sudden become hocus pocus, kabbalzer, and Pesach. So what is this Chumrah based on? So the Chumrah is probably based on as follows, that even though the overwhelming majority of Rishayim learned in the Sukkim and Maseches Chulin, this principle of Ein Balua Yadzibikli, which becomes the source, the corollary of Ein Balua Yadzibikli, the Ran disagrees. The Ran is a whole Shtikotahor, Razdal, Shtikotahor, Maseches Chulin, where he claims that maybe that line in the Gemara, we don't really paskin like, it's part of a whole Shachbatar, the Shalak Yalocha. And the Ran throws a curveball at this sugya. So Mikra, then we don't pass like this Ran. Mikra, then we pass in that Taka ain't kli balei mikli alei deirotev and chatichiyot bechatichal deirotev. But since there is one opinion to be shared that maintains that this is a problem, so therefore for Pesach we linked onto this shita. Since this is the accepted practice, what the Ramah quotes, this is the reason why when it comes to for Pesach we will kasher our grapes, we will kasher the top of our stoves. I think we mentioned at the end of the shiur last time that me'ika mikra did. If you move into a tray for house, me'ika did, you don't really have to kasher the stove top. I didn't say the ovens yet, me'ika did, you don't really have to kasher the stove top because it's enkli balamikli. The ilum does. Nobody goes into a tray for house and doesn't kasher the stove top. But me'ika mikra did, it's really not necessary. That's why we're a little bit more lenient. Sometimes we get these frantic phone calls from people on their ski trips, in vacation time, that they're in this ski lodge or in this house, and they can't cash in the soft top. So the ikra did is probably okay, except for Pesach. Since the kashering of the stove top for Pesach is really a chumrah, it's not really mikra din, therefore the poskim right. What if the event somebody didn't? What if somebody didn't kasher the stove top properly and they ended up cooking by mistake the chosher Pesach food on? It's a bit the event of food kosher. We're not going to adke de kachu. Even the chometz has its limitations. We're not going to trafe up. We're not going to say the food is chometz dick. Since again mikra din, we rely on the sitting of the chetchila during the rest of the year. Because this kashering, even for Pesach, is really a little bit more of a chumrah, not an ikra din. Therefore, the Mishnah Berurah writes in Uchas Pesach that you can rely on the very, very low level of kashering for this. We'll speak about this a little bit a few minutes from now when we get into the issue of ovens. There are basically three different styles, so to speak, of kashering, even including heat. There's the two basic ones, there's Agola and there's Libra, and then there's something a little bit in the middle. So Agola is usually reserved for things that receive the bliya through water, or through some liquid medium. Once I stirred my pot of chicken soup with a milchik spoon, so now I want to kasher the spoon, so the spoon has to be thrown into a pot of boiling water. That's Agola. And the other extreme is Libra, something that a bliya happened literally on the fire. So I stuck my fork, a milchik fork onto a burger over on the grill or something. So there's no liquid, so that's direct heat. So that requires a libun. Then it has to be kashered with a direct application of fire. You can't just throw it into a pot of water. Those are the two extremes. And then there's a third kind of kashering that doesn't appear in the Gemara. It appears in the Rishonim, what's called libun kal. So what does libun kal mean? Libun kal means the direct heat, but it doesn't get as hot as regular libun would be. Regular libun gets very, very hot. The Yerushalmi starts talking about how it's peeling and meiselach and it's just nitzim and the sparks are flying. It's really, really hot for a libun, well, libun gomor. Libun kal is, it's exposed to the fire, but doesn't get as hot. So the general rule in the Rishonim, who the Mordechai quotes Rishonim, who in a sense made up this new category of libun kal, they basically say as follows, that libun kal is not going to be sufficient if something really requires libun min hadin. But if something doesn't really require libun, it really requires hagola. It's just that it's logistically hard to do hagola. You don't have a pot big enough or something. So you want to do libun, but you don't want to do a 1,000-degree libun. So then libun kal is good enough. So basically libun kal is something that doesn't appear in the Gemara. It's an innovation of the Rishonim. It's good enough, it's hot enough to exempt something that only required hagola in the first place. So the Mishnah Berurah quotes the same idea when it comes to kashering stovetops, let's say for Pesach. So you don't need a libun gomer. If this would be a real din, that mamash is a real pliya mikra din, so then you could argue maybe you need a real kashering. But this whole thing is a chumr bi'alma, it's only a chumr duchome, it's a chayshish, that's yoch that we don't follow. So the Mishnah Berurah writes, that's good enough just to do a libun kal on this. And that's what our practice is. When we kasher our stovetops, so we, at least in the old style way, so we just turn on the fire for a while until it gets hot enough to the point of libun kal. What is libun kal? How hot is libun kal? So it's doing to you, you look at the books and you look and try to figure out what's going on in the kitchen. So the poskim used the phrase, it's so hot that if you would put a straw down to the thing, it would start to be nisraf. It would start to burn.
Straw, so, meaning non-drinking straw.
Yeah, correct. Yes. A straw like they used to feed to the straw. Yeah. So I don't recommend to try to do this today, although when I was a kid, I used to try to experiment. It never worked. Someone explained to me that they coat the thing in such a way it's not going to work. I don't understand exactly what happens. But Lamai said, the Rishonim write, that when the Kli is Yatza, let us bow, base the other, that the Kli is so boiling, so burning hot that if you touch your finger would burn on both sides. And no matter where you touch in this Kli, your finger would burn. You could rest assured that it's reached the point of libun kal. So again, I have not experimented this. I'm not planning on doing so in the near future. But if you turn on the fire over your grates in your stove, I don't think it's going to take very long for that metal to get pretty, pretty hot. Am I correct? Yeah, okay, I think we're in a very, very short amount of time. You're going to reach the point this year of libun kal. So again, I can't give you a magic number. 15 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, it's odd. I don't think anyone's actually experimented to see, but I'm pretty comfortable after a few minutes of leaving on your stovetop that should be good enough. There is, many people have a practice where they kasher the stovetops for Pesach, which is the ikra, the mechumra in a sense. Kashering for treif is not even really a chumra, but just a minute that people do. So the question is, what do people do? So a lot of people, what they do is that they don't want to just stop turn on the fire. They want to make it a little bit Kabbalah Kaspoto. So they'll put a pot of water on top of the burner. So that way it keeps the heat in a little bit more to almost like rush the job, making the grates get a little bit hotter a little bit quicker. So you just have to make sure there's enough water in there, otherwise you'll start a fire. So you have to many people cash their stovetops that way. Many people want to save some time, so they kasher all four grates at the same time. That's not a good idea because it starts to get very hot very quickly, and sometimes it will chip away at some of the enamel or something. So I had that unfortunate experience the first year after we got married. my first Pesach in California when my mother-in-law was so excited that someone was going to come and help her kasher the kitchen. So I did it right. I kashered the kitchen and broke her stove. So that was a... So Baruch Hashem, she's forgiven me over the years, but that wasn't a good way to start off first Yadav. So I learned my lesson the hard way that you do two burners at a time. Two burners at a time. And it doesn't have to be so high in gas. And Shalom Yisrael, that's good enough. And again, the whole thing is Chumra B'Yama. For whatever reason, the person didn't do it. So with the Yadav, the food is going to be kosher. Anyway, now people like to do things easy. So they like to throw the grates into the self-cleaning oven. So that will definitely do the job. Depending on the kind of grates that you have, so they may, it'll either turn colors or crack or whatever it'll do. So I cannot vouch for that. We're still for the old timers. We still do it the old style way, just two burners at a time with the fire on, with the pots of water on, and then you can use the same pots of water to kasher your sink, so you cannot kill two birds with one stone. So that's just kashering ABC for Pesach. But again, the basic principle that's governing all of what we're talking about is that liquids are the medium that brings about bleias. It's based on this that we now move on to the next part of our kitchen and the next part of our mice and yoredeya is as follows. That we've been talking a lot about mashkin, a lot about liquids. So there is a big discussion in the poskim about steam. Is steam considered to be a halachically a liquid or not? Is steam considered to be the equivalent of something that causes bleias? So we all know back from our chemistry the first day that steam is basically H2O water in a gas state. But we're not quite sure, api alocha, whether that's considered to be the same as water and liquid and bleas are affected. So there is a tshuva of the Rosh that the Shulchan Aruch quotes the halacha that assumes that zeya is considered to be like a mashka. And therefore the Rosh writes that if a person has, let's say, a pot of milk that's cooking and he puts a flasher cover on top of it, so that's going to cause a lot of problems. Because even though no milk necessarily is splattering up, but since the zeya, since the steam is shooting up and hitting the bottom of the flashing pot, so that's going to cause bleia problems. Now you have bleias of milk, even though, again, the milk's in the bottom of the pot, but the steam that's coming out of the milk, the pot of milk, halachah is considered to be like the milk, and that causes bleia problems. And then that steam may now bring down bleias from on top and shoot it back down again, and you just trafed up your pot, you just trafed up your cover, everything just became trafe, because zeya is considered to be like mashke. How in the world did the Rosh know that zeya is considered to be like mashke? So he dug up a Mishnah, Maseches Machshir, in all places. Like Abi Hilchus Tuma, there's such a halacha that zeya is considered to be like mashke in terms of intricacies of Hilchus Tuma. So other Acharonim, the later Acharonim, question whether that's even true, whether that comparison is correct. Mishkinus Yaakov has a tshuva. Yaakov was the Talmud of Chaim Volozhiner. I don't know whether he was present at the first day of Elohim. Some of you may have heard Rabbi Tarragon spoke yesterday after the 9th minyan. So I don't know if he said the same thing by the Shkar minyan. So he told me a Gevalka story about the first day of Elohim. He said that there were two yeshivas that were started around the same time. Elohim started, and there was another yeshiva, another city in Eastern Europe, that was started around the same time. And the other yeshiva, Bechlal, never succeeded. We never heard of it. Never know what. So that particular Rosh Yeshiva once approached Reb Chaim Volozhiner and asked him, he said, my high half of Volozhiner became the yeshiva parks the lines, and my yeshiva there couldn't make it just the first year. So Reb Chaim Volozhiner asked him, what did you do on the first day of this man? So that Rosh Yeshiva said, the first day we had a Zachanukas Abayis. I'm not standing there at Torah Chanukas Abayis yet, but we had a Chanukas Abayis, we had dancing and singing, and we had a, you know, such a, it was Labor Day, the whole town came and everything. So Reb Chaim Volozhiner said, I'll tell you what we did. We had a Tainus Tzibur for the whole town of Volozhin, and we said to him the entire day with tears that we should be Matzliach. So then when we are a Torah planning committee, we'll see which the answer was that the other yeshiva was a Galitz yeshiva, not Siyad yeshiva, this was a Lipsh yeshiva, there was no brains, we'll say to him and have Tainus Tzibur. So the rest is history. So Rishkas Yaakov was one of the early Talmidim, so maybe it was the end of that first day. So he was an early Talmidim of Chaim Volozhiner. So he writes in his Tshuvas that Mechilas covered the Heliger Rosh, even though the Shulchan Aruch quotes the Rosh to Allah, he says he doesn't know that's right. He says, like, Mechat Eisim, like, and he says, Adam Hashem, don't quote. He says, I don't know, maybe there's no such din. Maybe this whole din doesn't exist. So Lemaisa, we don't really follow this Mishkas Yaakov. We follow what it says in Shulchan Aruch. The Ramad doesn't argue. The Shach, the Taz, the Regal, and the Sekelim assume that this equation from Tuma to Trefus to Kashrus is correct, and therefore we do treat liquids as the equivalent steam, the equivalent of liquids. But in the back of our mind, we always have like a little shtickle sniff lachol, whatever. We have different shilas and hilchos zeya, so we throw back at the end and say, well, and even if it's also for other mishkas yakov, maybe it's more for the mishkas yakov's reason. So we keep the mishkas yakov in the back, no pun intended, on the back burner. But it's not the conventional wisdom. We usually assume that there is an issue of zeya. So this issue of Zeya has now raised a significant red flag in our kitchens, because all of our ovens are potentially subject to this sugya of Zeya. Because let's say I cook some meat dish in my oven, and so even though you, let's say, assume that the meat is not splattering all over the walls of the oven, but there is some Zeya that's coming out, some of the steam of the gravy is coming into the walls of the oven, so that just made the oven fleshix. So now that oven becomes like the sugi that we started with a couple of weeks ago, kederi shebishol v'basar, lo yivashe b'cholov. If you have a pot that you cook meat in, you're not supposed to cook milk in that pot. So here, it's not a pot that you cook meat, but it's the walls of the oven that have now basically, halachically, been considered to be cooked meat, kederi shebishol v'basar. So now I'm not allowed to take that same kedera, i.e. that same oven, and then cook milk in that oven later. And if I do so, so then I raise the benayis in tam. So then the tam that's balua inside the walls of the oven is going to presumably come out as going to now cause basar cholov inside whatever subsequent milchik dish that I'm cooking. So if you follow the rushes in the Shulchan Aruch's equation, that steam is like liquid. So then there's a classic application of kederi shebishol basar v'basar cholov in bishul. I raise the benayis in tam. So is that true? So there are a couple of nuances as to just how true or how not true that is. So one question that the Muslim raise is that do all foods really give off Zeya? Are the facts right? So even if the Rush is right, that equation is true, that when there's Zeya, that's considered like a mashke, do all foods really give off that Zeya? So there is a Pribugodim that dug up a Rambam in Hilchus Tumatarim. So it's all Tumashav, it's all Tumasugis. So he dug up a Rambam, and the Rambam seems to say that this din of Zeya, which is like Mashke, which is, again has its old roots, the whole source of Bechel Kustum V'tara, so maybe this is only true when we talk about Zeya's Mashke, now we talk about Zeya's Oichlin, that when you have a liquid, like a big, big pan of gravy or something, so that gives off a Zah Mashke, a Zah Zeya, and that Zeya, the halacha has to consider to be like a liquid. But Shein Ken, if you have a dry piece of chicken, you know, baking in your oven, so how much does a dry piece of chicken give off? So, I mean, everything has a little bit of moisture. We're all made up of moisture, but we're all 90% water, whatever we are. The whole world is water, but afa pichein, there's a big difference between the steam that's caused by a davar shamash, yeah, in contrast to a steam that's caused by a davar yavesh. So the people got him as a deer from the Rambam that maybe that wouldn't be considered to be a zeh altogether. So even if the Shulchan Aruch and the Rush are right, that Zeya is a problem in halacha, maybe Zeya's oichem is not a problem. So the later post can point out that Lemaisa and the Ramah doesn't sound that way. The Ramah talks about Zeya on dry piece of meat, as the Ramah talks about if you have a piece of meat hanging over a pot of milk and everything is dry. And the Ramah doesn't seem to distinguish between oichem versus mashka. So it's not 100% clear. So Ramesh Feinstein has a tshuva, almost a little bit of a pshara between the two. Moshe writes that we shouldn't go to the extreme to say that whenever it's a solid, it's fine. Nothing to worry about. Zeya, that far I think is a little bit too much to go. On the other end, to say that dry foods are the same as liquid, you see it's not true. You see that when the food is dry, it doesn't give off the degree of steam that the liquid does. So Moshe writes that maybe we should take the following approach to the sugya. He says that if we look at this dry food, and it really looks like it's giving off steam. We see it, like all the steam is developing inside. We can't close our eyes to reality. He said, you can't, I mean, if you believe in a diyuk and a ram, then you can close your eyes to what's going on inside the oven. And, we're not so sure about that. So if lemaisa, we see steam there, so then we have to reckon with it, we have to be concerned with it. But if you don't see it, what you don't see doesn't hurt you. You're not mechuyav to go stick your head inside the oven and to look and see, is the steam there? If you know what you're doing is basically a dry kind of a food, so then mikra, then you can probably assume that it's not really producing any significant amount of zeya, and you don't have to be worried about it. So again, yesh v'yesh, the Rambam sheet is across the board. Some will make outright like that, Prima Gadam's Diak in the Rambam. Others will say, we never heard of such a chiluk, the Ramad doesn't sound the way, and others walk a little bit of a summer in the middle. So that's one factor to keep in mind. There is another question about Zeya. The original case of Zeya that the Rush in the Shulchan Aruch was describing was a very, very closed-in area of Zeya. Where you have, they described there was a pot, and Imamish took a milch cover and stuck it on top of a fleshy pot, and vice versa. So the Zeya has nowhere to go. The Zeya is hitting the pot on top, it's coming back down. There's no place for the Zeya to exit. That's a very, very highly concentrated Zeya. Poskim discuss what if the Zayah has exits and has places for it to go away, so it doesn't collect in one area to such an extent. So maybe that's not the equivalent of Zayah. So that was a question that was posed, that maybe our ovens are b'chlal not included in Zayah, because our ovens have vents, safety vents, all kind of things for stuff to air out of. So some wanted to suggest that maybe that's considered to be enough to circumvent the entire problem of Zayah. So Ramesha didn't think that was right. He thought that, I don't know where the oven vents have changed in the last 70 years, I don't know. Ramesha didn't think that we could just be making straight out of ovens the way they are. So basically we're kind of left with this little bit of unclarity in terms of what our take is on ovens. If I want to use an oven for Plashis, I don't want to use the oven again for Milchik, so is that the best thing or not? So there's another factor that also gets thrown into this equation, and that's what's based on the Gemara. The Gemara tells a story in Maseches Chulin that once they forgot to take the kidney out of an animal, and they roasted the animal with its kidney. So the problem is that the kidney has chelev on it. There's fat in the kidney that's treif. So the question was, did the fat ooze out and spread out and now potentially treif up other parts of the animal? So the Gemara says that no, that there was a krum, there was a kidney, the fat, I'm not holding the biology, but the fat and the chelev that would potentially treif up the rest of the meat was covered with a membrane. So that membrane was blocking the chelev from oozing all over the place. So we showed him right. You see from that Gemara that if you have something that's treif, but it's contained, but it's closed, there's something blocking it, so it's not going anywhere. I say even real liquid, even real oozing fat is not going anywhere if it's closed up, if it's stuffed up with the krum. So some wanted to suggest that whenever you have something that's covered, let's say I put something into an oven, but the mice is covered, so I covered it with something. So even if the blea is going, where the blea is going, they're not going anywhere. So why should that covering be any better and any worse than the krum and on the kidney? The problem is that the Rishonim have a big machlokes whether we really, really follow that principle that appears in the Gemara about the krum and the kidneys. The Gemara quotes that as one possibility, then the Gemara may reject that possibility. So some of the Rishonim already write that we don't like to be making like that. We don't like to say that just because it's covered with something, it's okay. The cover's going to fall off, the krum's going to rip. A lot of logistical problems. Really, really, honest to goodness, if it's really covered, it's hard to believe that any bleas are happening. But as a practice in our kitchens, we don't like to rely on that. So the Ramo quotes that idea. He doesn't quote about covering things in ovens. He talks about krums and kidneys. He says that we shy away from relying on that cooler, not running to go run after that cooler. So now you start to combine factors together. You know, Rabbi, I want to know, I have an oven, so tell me, what am I supposed to do with this oven? This is oven, a milch, it's a treif, it's a pie, but what do I do with this oven? So there are different opinions, mamash, across the spectrum as to what our take should be on ovens. So there are some poskim who say we have to be the biggest machmim on the ovens, and you have to keep your oven fleishes, and if you want to make anything milch, you got to buy some milch oven. You have to have two ovens. You can't use the same oven back and forth. That's kedei reshavishna v'basla v'ashbacholam, and everything's terrible. And other poskim will buma mekel. Other poskim start to make cheshbonis and say, figure out what your oven's going to be. Most of us use our ovens for more fleishes than milchiks. So you're probably going to have a fleishig oven. So now, once in a while, you want to cook milchiks in it. So maybe you should keep a few things in mind. First of all, what are you cooking? Are you cooking something that says, liquid? Is it really, really liquidy? So again, I know about as much about cooking milchiks as I do about the kidneys on animals. But from what my wife tells me is that most of the milchik dishes that we make don't have such liquids in them anyway. So they're not so juicy, so liquidy. So maybe one could argue that most of the things that we're making are not really liquid anyway. They're probably closer to, Ramosha says, probably not such a significant amount of Zeya there. So probably Mikra Din, they're really okay. The yes is ace, it's probably a good idea. Once you try to cover milchiks, if one has a fleshy oven, like probably most of us do, and using that oven for milchiks, so it's a good idea to cover it, even though we're not the biggest fans of the covering kula, but you know, mikra din is probably okay. Gemara does say it, at least at one stage, and it's probably just the chumra not to rely on the covering. So that's what I usually tell people to do, that they should keep their oven as fleshiks, and then if and when they need to make milchiks, they should always try to cover it. And then they inevitably get the next question, Rabbi, I can't cover it. My wife said it's the kind of thing you can't get covered. So then I asked them, so what kind of food is it? Is it really a liquid? Is it really a salad? So if it's really a salad, a total salad, so then no, you can rely on it. And if it's really, really a liquid, so then they're making them also. So there are some poskim who say maybe you have the vent cooler there, and there's always the Mishnah Yachav in the back of a mind, and some people throw in for good luck, it's more than 24 hours, and so it's no derises anyway, no chashashas, and the evidence everything's going to be moved there anyway. And there are some who say that maybe our ovens are different, and there's no real zay in our ovens, and therefore yesh l'hokol l'gamre. So there are across the spectrum in terms of different opinions, in terms of our ovens. Even in our yeshiva, there are different opinions, different of the senior Rosh Yeshiva about what I take in ovens are. There are some who are very, very make on ovens, and all our ovens are not built. There's very little of zay in our ovens, and nothing to worry about. And others are a little bit more conservative zay in ovens. So there are different psakim that exist in Klai Yisrael about the ovens. I think as a general rule, and I think the most centrist view, whatever it is, the most general compromised view in this whole area is keep your ovens fleishiks, and if and when you want to use for milchiks, try to cover whatever you can, if for whatever reason you can. So then it's a solid food, yesh more machal hokol. If it's a liquid food, so I'll tell you who to ask, I'll tell you that that's also going to be probably okay. What if a person wants to cash their oven? So they want to cash their oven for multiple reasons. Either because, let's say they have a fleishik oven, now they decide they want to turn it into a milchik oven. So we have a general practice not to do that. The Magen Avraham quotes an age-old practice, and an Ashkenazi practice, not the kasha kalim back and forth from fleishik to milchik. Otherwise, it's going to be a big mikshel. People are going to forget. I had this beautiful set of fleishik silverware. Then I decide I want to use it for milchik. And then next week, I want to use it back for fleishik. And the following week for milchik. And someone's going to forget what it is. So the minig became that we don't kasha things back and forth, just the flippantly from fleishik to milchik. But there are some coolers in that minig. So one of the coolers in that minig, the famous cool of that minig, is the cool of kashrim for Pesach. That if you're kashrim for Pesach anyway, then it's okay. But the emes is, the original source for that cooler was, if you're kashrim for Pesach because you want to use it for Pesach, what's happened in America is a little bit of a funny thing, that most people don't even kash things for Pesach today. Who kashes silver for Pesach today? Most people don't do that. So the Chassam Sofer writes that if you have your fleishik silverware and you want to kashrim for Pesach anyway, so then once you kashrim it, then you can turn around and turn it to milchik. So most people today don't even kashrim Pesach, but they kashrim before Pesach, not for Pesach. They left out the word before. It's before instead of for. They kashrim before Pesach, and they my great grandmother told me that when you kash things for Pesach, you're allowed to switch it. That's not exactly what your great grandmother meant, but whatever. It's at the end of the world. The poskim are pretty makel when you have items that probably don't have to kash it anyway. Things that chumras and hugging them and the ovens were far from muskim where you have to cash the oven altogether. So those who want to cash it, those kinds of things from fleishiks to milchiks, that's probably not really included in that minig altogether. So again, if a person wants to cash their oven, even from fleishiks to milchiks, or they want to cash their oven from treif to, so they move into a goyish apartment, they want to cash their oven for treifas, or they want to really cash their oven for Pesach. So what do you do? What if anything is necessary to cash the oven? They don't want to be bothered with covering. They don't want to be bothered with Zayas, with Eichlin, with Mashkin. They want it to be Lagamri back to square one. So what method is necessary to kasher an oven? So this was a major, major machloikis in the Gedolei Olam of America. We just quoted yesterday another machloikis with Moshe Rehenkin. Moshe Rehenkin were the two big pillars of Psak Halacha back in the... In the early years of not the early years of American Jewry, but the early years of post-war American Jewry, when a lot of the minhagim and a lot of the practices of Klai Yisrael were mamash becoming a nikva, we said that people we don't even appreciate how now we're 70, 80 years later, how most of the day-to-day kind of things that we do today that are so mukubal in the Jewish community, so much of it comes back from that tkufa, from around the 40s and the 50s when Ramosha, Rankin, Mamash bin Kaveya, what a lot of them in Hage Klai Yisrael at the time. I said this many times, that Rav Shimon Haider was probably the biggest Kaveya of the practices in America than anybody else. He says his little books, he was Kaveya for sure. He was Kaveya all the Minhag Yisrael and all the camps and all the slipway camps and all the hotels for the 3 weeks and the 9 days. The Lishim Sofik, he was Kaveya all the Minhag America for the last 70 years. And many, many, many other things. He was the trailblazer in Chol Shabbos and all the things that we now consider to be just standard practice goes back to the Tamidim of, it was really the Tamidim of Rav Moshe and Rankin. Kotler, the Rav, those people who were around back in the 50s and the 60s who predated our practices today. So this particular issue about how to kasher ovens was a major machlokes also between Rav Moshe and Rav Henkin. So Rav Moshe was of the opinion that ovens are really, really bad, and they require the highest level of kashering possible. Why? Because there's no liquid. We said it's dry heat. So we said before, libun. Whenever you have a belia that's done through a direct source of a fire, a flame, so it requires libun. And what kind of libun? Not a cheapy make-believe libun cow. It requires a libun gum with a real highest makoy of libun. That's the only way to kasher an oven. And therefore, Rav Moshe, who was getting back in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, so Rav Moshe writes, and how are you going to do that? How in the world are you going to reach that degree of heat? So Rav Moshe's like, you turn on the oven. The oven's going to reach 550. 550 is fall short of what's called Liban Gomer. It's not going to reach that shear with the Babli, the Rishabi talk about how hot it has to be. So there's no way to kasher an oven, finished. The only way to kasher an oven, says Rav Moshe, is if you mamish take a direct flame and you apply it to every single inch of the oven, and you stick your head in with a blowtorch, and you go ahead and you kasher every single inch of the oven, that's the only way to do it. So that's what Moshe said. So I am going to give a disclaimer right now that nobody in this room should try such a stunt. Nobody here is trained how to do such a stunt, and the ramifications, except for maybe Ron Lechter, the ramifications of doing such a thing incorrectly are potentially disastrous. I will not elaborate upon this, but I think some of you may know what I'm referring to. After the tapes are off, I'll explain to you exactly what I'm referring to, that the kashering is a very, very serious business. We know as a VAD, we have insurance against kashering mishaps. That's very, very serious stuff. So bottom line is nobody should try such a stunt. So what's left for us? According to Rav Moshe, Moshe himself writes, so for the average guy in the Lower East Side doesn't know how to kasher an oven with blowtorches. So what's he going to do? So Rav Moshe writes, you can't kasher your oven. What are we doing for Pesach? I call food for a whole week. What are we going to do for Pesach? Rav Moshe says, no, what you can do is like this. You can buy what's called an oven insert. You can buy a little metal box, and you can stick it inside the oven, and then you don't have to kasher your oven anymore. Then the food's inside something new. It's inside your little box. And you turn on your oven and shine, and wonderful. So I grew up with an oven insert. I also grew up with cold food on Pesach. I don't know, it didn't work so well. It worked depending on the mood. My kids, couldn't even be mastered. And again, I did not grow up in the stone. Just the other day, I was talking to my kids. Lima asked me yesterday. She asked me about running water, whether I grew up with running water. But I do remember not running water, but I do remember, my sink on Pesach, and I remember my oven on Pesach. The sink on Pesach, we had a sink insert because we had a porcelain sink, so you couldn't kasher. We had a sink insert. It was basically a big chunk of metal with some Hamish guy carved a little hole that was approximately the size of the drain, but lavdafka. And I still have these images of my mother, like at 3-4 o'clock in the morning after the Seder, you know, trying to pour out the extra water that wouldn't drain out by itself. And with that, with the oven insert that did or did not necessarily heat up the food depending on its mood. So that was basically, this was not the Stone Ages, this was the 1970s in Riverdale. It wasn't so long ago. Anyway, so that's where Moshe went. There's no way to kasher an oven finished. It's too, unless you do Mamash Libin Gomer. So Rav Henkin responded to Moshe, I don't understand. He said, why is there a bliya in an oven in the first place? The only reason why there's a bliya in the oven in the first place is because the Rosh told us, he dug up a Mishnah Machshirin that says that Zeh is considered to be like Mashke. So he said, so Zozan is like Mashke. So if it's like Mashke, so then it's Kabbalah Kachpoto like Mashke. So you should be able to kasher it with Hagalah. That's what Hankin said. He said, if you think that the whole, if you think there's no problem whatsoever, then it became chametz in the first place. The only reason to say that it became chametz was that it became chametz to a mashke, to a zeh, which is like a mashke. So the way to kasher is through mashke, through a goel. So you're probably wondering, let me take my oven and throw it into the pot of water. No, but now the Rishonim save us. Remember we said before, anything that requires a goel, and for logistical reasons you can't do a goel, so you do libun kal. So Liban Kal is good enough. It's B'machom Agol. Liban Kal is not good enough when you need real Liban, but Liban Kal is suffice when all you need is Agol. That's what Henkin said. So do Liban Kal. How hot does Liban Kal have to get? Remember we said before, Liban Kal has to get hot enough that any time you touch any part of whatsoever, so you're going to burn your finger. I guarantee you, you turn on your oven to 550, leave it there for a while, and you touch any place there, you won't have a finger left. So Henkin said, it was good enough. You did Agol / Liban Kal. That was the Machoikis B'Akotzer L'Kotzer. So then a third group of Gedolim got into this mix. That was Rabbi Cutler, and then the Rav got into this mix also. and said, wait a second, we have a nupshat. Nish like Rav Moshe, nor like Rav Henkin. He said, well, oilam, you need libun, and you need libun gomor, you have to have the highest possible libun. But you know what? We have three words that govern all of Hilchos Kashrut. You know what it's called? Kebolo, kach, polto. So, b'med v'mamurim, that the Bavli and the Rishalmi say, you need these tremendous heat temperatures in order to create libun. That's in the old days, but they had no way of measuring what heat was. So we had no way of knowing how hot this oven ever got. So therefore, you need the highest possible shear of libun. But if you have a scientific way of knowing that the oven never got past the following point, it can't. You know why? Because it shuts off. It's got a thermostat on it. It never, ever got past 550. So if you put it up to 550, you just did libun gomor. Not like Rav Henkin who said, you don't need libun, you really just need hagol, and libun kal is good enough. Not like Rav Moshe said, it's libun gomor, it's impossible. So Rav Aaron Cutler and the Rav, and Rav Haji Yosef, and other poskim said, no, the middle ground is right. You need libun gomor, and you have it, by simply putting it up to 550. Because kebol kach polto, you know it never physically could have gotten reached past that point. So now Shem Naida comes back to help us, and Shem Naida says that when he spoke to Rav Aaron Cutler about this years ago, so he asked Rav Aaron, so how long does it take? This is not halakha. This is a scientific question. This is a kitchen. Got to ask an oven dealer about this. How hot does it take for it to reach the point of kebolo kach polto, to reach the hottest it could possibly get? So Shimon Haider writes that Rav Aaron told him a few hours. So he writes in a parenthesis that, most respectfully, he says he doesn't know that Rav Aaron understood exactly. He said, Rav Aaron said a few hours, but he said, the mumchim have told us that after a certain amount of time, it's not getting any hotter. Whatever heat it reached, it's not getting hotter in 6 hours than it was in 1 hour. So it's nearly loymar, he writes, that even Rav Aaron, if they would have explained to him a little bit, whatever it was, he says, an hour. That's what he writes. More than an hour, he said, ad kedem, more than an hour, not between you and me, it's less than an hour. It's probably significantly less than an hour. So there are different rabbanim give you different numbers, how much we're going to chisel away. But it's be'ikaron, Rav Aaron Cutler's pshat, that you need kebol kach polto. So Rav Aaron just said, a few hours. So Shimon Haider said a few, blushin yochik, 1 hour. That's probably less than an hour also. So again, different nuances, exactly how hot it has to get. But that's the middle ground in terms of kashrut. So it leaves us with an array of different possibilities in terms of kashrut ovens. So hopefully we'll try to pick this up next week in terms of the regular ovens. Then we'll try to move into the microwave ovens and try to put this whole picture into our kitchens into place in terms of the different pliyas that come about through these quasi-zeya/mashkin. Okay, let's do next week.